If Washington wants to get right with voters, it has to start listening to them. Welcome to Beyond the Bubble. I'm Kristen Roberts, Washington editor for the 30 news organizations all around America that together make McClatchy.
And I'm Patricia Mazzei, lead political writer for the Miami Herald.
Every week, we call the reporters who live and work in political battleground states and ask them to tell us how voters are reacting to Donald Trump and Republican Washington.
And what issues matter to them outside the Beltway that Washington still isn't dealing with.
On the hook this week, Colin Campbell of the News and Observer in Raleigh, Brian Lowry of the Kansas City Star, and Alex Rorty, national political correspondent.
So, Kristen, what do you want to talk about this week?
I want to start with the Around America segment because I want to hear from all of you about what's playing politically in your states.
Then Alex Rorty is going to interview a Democratic pollster who says they have internal numbers that give them hope about their future with white working class votes.
And then we'll jump into the lightning round where each of you gets to identify some politician making moves for 2018. Before we start, let me just say thank you for all the great feedback we're getting. Please keep sending your questions and your ideas and tell us what's happening in your state. Email us at btb@mcclatchy.com. That's BTB as in Beyond the Bubble.
Kristen, you ready?
I'm ready. Let's go.
January 20th, the day the people became the rulers of this nation again.
Our ideals and fundamental values are being attacked. Do we retreat or do we fight? I say we fight.
He heard those voices that were out there that other people weren't hearing, and he just earned a mandate.
It is time for Democrats to grow a backbone and get out there and fight.
The American people would like to try something new. We would like to see the country go in a different direction to change the course for America.
He doesn't take this presidency seriously enough.
So to all Americans, hear these words. You will never be ignored again.
All right, let's say hello to our very smart panel. Colin Campbell, how are you?
Good. I just got back from a day at the beach, so I'm well-rested and excited for another week of politics.
Oh, God, I'm so jealous. Hello, Brian Lowry.
Aloha. It's good to be back from vacation.
Alex, hello.
Kristen, it's wonderful to be here as always.
All right, let's get right to the Around America segment. And the first person on deck, Patty Mazzei.
Well, I'm going to start us off with, as usual, Florida looks south to its neighbors. We've got a bunch of Miami Republican lawmakers who have adopted the cause of Venezuela as the new Cuba, essentially. It is their new foreign policy crusade. And it has been for years. They have criticized the administration of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. And they do this out of a sincere belief that he might be the next Fidel Castro. But it's also politics, and that's not something that I think people outside of South Florida are aware of as much, even within the state of Florida. As of the 2013 census, Florida had 104,000 Venezuelans, and that number has gone up dramatically. I mean, the number of asylum requests tripled just from 2015 to 2016. And in a symbolic Venezuelan election here a few weeks ago, 103,000 people voted just in Miami-Dade, Broward, and Palm Beach counties alone. So that is why we are seeing Florida Governor Rick Scott, who is planning to run for Senate, we think, next year, making weekly appeals to Venezuelan voters. It's why we're seeing Marco Rubio, Carlos Curbelo, Mario Diaz-Balart, all members of Congress, taking this to be such a big issue because they think this could be a real block of voters that the Republican Party could win over. They are single-issue voters right now. They care only about the Venezuelan cause. And that means that whoever is in office who can help them, be them Democrat or Republican, they will side with them. And that is how Cubans got to be such a strong Republican voting bloc. And even though the numbers of Venezuelans aren't nearly as high, they see this as a possibility moving forward. So we're going to be watching this as the Trump administration continues to escalate sanctions against the Venezuelan government.
So is there evidence that this is a Republican voting bloc and not a Democratic?
Not yet. There is not enough evidence one way or the other, really. Venezuelans voted mostly for John McCain for president in 2008, but then they swung to Barack Obama in 2012. There are Democrats who think Venezuelans really align more with Democrats. Just in general, they tend to be a little more in favor of government intervention in the economy. Having said that, however, the Miami Democrats I've spoken to, several political consultants, are worried that because the Obama administration didn't really take as hard a line against Maduro as Venezuelans would have liked and actually pushed for dialogue, that Republicans could now really pick up this group moving forward. I get the impression that the White House is really following Rubio's lead on this, as it has with other Latin American policy, as it has with Cuba. He's been in touch with Vice President Mike Pence and with the president himself. And he said last week that he was really grateful for the president's support in sanctioning 13 Venezuelan individuals. And that's something that Rubio was just instrumental to orchestrating.
What unifies us here today in this cause, to be frank, is not interference in another country's affairs, but support for its people. It's people who are demanding respect of liberty and democracy that they have worked so hard on, especially a country like Venezuela, has such a historic legacy of democracy in the region.
You know, I think one way to stump any politician in North Carolina would be to ask them about the politics of Venezuela. I guess the demographics up here are a little bit different, where I highly doubt any of them are paying attention or even really have an opinion on any aspect of this.
That's really interesting because there was a government-backed election in Venezuela on Sunday, and there were protests in cities around the world with Venezuelans. And I was very surprised to see that one of those cities was Denver, and Representative Mike Kaufman showed up and tried to speak Spanish and was reading off a statement and was laughing at his own bad Spanish. And so suddenly I was like, wow, it's not just Miami anymore.
I'm curious. I mean, do Venezuelans... would you say that they're culturally conservative when it comes to social issues? Is that, I mean, are there more issues than just the politics of Venezuela that Republicans can appeal to them on?
Right now, I don't think there are. And traditionally, Venezuelan elections have not been on cultural issues. I mean, we're talking about a country that is almost entirely Roman Catholic, and some of these questions are just not even debated in the public sphere. So I'm not sure they're going to try, Republicans or Democrats, to appeal to them on social issues. Democrats, I think, are going to keep trying to play the domestic issue card, you know, education, healthcare, like they do to other Hispanic groups. But there is a real sense that they could lose them just on the Venezuelan politics issue. And that's why Bill Nelson, who is up for re-election next year, who is a Democrat in the Senate, has also taken this. So I think it's just an explainer to the rest of the country that when you see this come up in Washington, it's not just because of a sincere belief that they're in trouble, but also because there's a real constituency here they're talking to.
And in a swing state like Florida, is this enough to tip the election one way or the other?
That's a really good question. I'm not sure that the numbers are there yet, but because the elections here are so close, I mean, we're talking about the 2014 governor's race being decided by 64,000 votes. If you have a group of people who suddenly swells to 100,000 voters and they end up voting as a block eventually, then yeah, they really could down the line.
All right, Colin Campbell, what's happening in North Carolina?
So North Carolina, we are awaiting a decision from a federal court about when our next election is going to be for state legislature. There's a redistricting case going on. A number of our legislative districts were struck down as unconstitutional racial gerrymanders by the Supreme Court a couple months back. Now it's a matter of timeline. When will the legislature be forced to redraw the districts? And will we have a special election in the early part of 2018? And then we have another regular election in late 2018 in November? Or will we wait until late 2018 to reelect our legislature under new maps? There was a hearing held in federal court in Greensboro last week. The federal judges took the Republicans here to task for, in their words, not being serious enough about redrawing the maps and sort of dragging their feet on this whole process. The ruling from the court, the Supreme Court, came out a couple months ago. So far, they're just now starting the redistricting process here. They want to take several months and not redraw the maps until November, the idea being that they could have more public hearings between now and then. They could take time to set up their criteria for how they draw the maps. But the plaintiffs in the case really want this to get done sooner. They say, you know, this is an unconstitutional legislature we have right now because they're serving in these districts that were racially gerrymandered. So the sooner those people can be reelected under constitutional districts, the better. And that's sort of the tension we're looking at here in North Carolina, with a lot of implications for how 2018 plays out.
You know, every time we talk about these redistricting cases and the gerrymandered map, you know, it sounds so geeky and in the weeds and frankly uninteresting, but at the heart of it, it's really racial politics at play, right? And is that something that's breaking through in North Carolina in a way that it's not nationally when we talk about redistricting?
Yeah, I think people here understand the level of racial politics at play. I mean, a lot of it does get sort of drowned out by the, does this benefit Democrats or does it benefit Republicans? But we certainly have a number of folks who are very concerned to see that the court's basically saying that these African-American voters are being packed into these tight districts drawn in weird, snaky fashions to sort of dilute their influence in other districts. And we're going to hear from Chanel James, who is a Greensboro Democrat and professor at UNC Greensboro, who's one of the plaintiffs in this legislative gerrymandering lawsuit.
The idea that in this day, people were moving African-Americans to other districts, in one sense, because they said that I would have more in common with one group than another group because they might be have more white people in them or more people who are different than African Americans. That conversation upset me.
That's the concern, but there's sort of a follow-up concern from legislative incumbents who are African-American. Several of them had a forum a couple weeks ago and said they're a little worried that Republicans may respond to this by double-bunking them and forcing some African-American legislators to lose their seats. So how this plays out from a racial standpoint is definitely far from a foregone conclusion.
This reminds me a little bit of the case in Florida where our districts were redrawn by the court, essentially, to walk everybody back. There was a state constitutional amendment passed that required no more gerrymandering. And in this case, they didn't argue on racial issues. They argued on the fact that it favored incumbents and political parties. And the court eventually weighed in and said, you guys have to follow this amendment, legislature, because they disagreed with the Senate maps. And that's when former Congresswoman Corinne Brown went to federal court and said her district should be kept the same because otherwise black voters would be disenfranchised. Now, she had the most gerrymandered district in the state. It went from Jacksonville south 140 miles to Orlando. And the court, you know, did not rule in her favor. And the biggest evidence of the fact that the new district did not disenfranchise black voters is that they elected another black Democrat to it, Congressman Al Lawson. So this is kind of in reverse almost. Here is the court saying there's racial gerrymandering as opposed to Corinne Brown arguing it.
Colin, what's the, I mean, there's basically, there's national stakes to this case, correct? I mean, we're talking about a federal case, and this is while we're having a huge debate about gerrymandering nationwide. In the backdrop, you have the controversy over Trump's voter commission, which obviously Chris Kobach, who lives very close to me, is one of the leaders of that. What's the sense from people in North Carolina of how important the stakes are in this case nationally?
I think this could definitely have implications for future racial gerrymandering cases around the country. If the court here decides to schedule this early election, that's pretty much a precedent that would suggest that any other time that districts get struck down around the country, you're going straight to the voting booth. And that's going to have a huge impact on how often we vote and weird voter turnout issues that could come up as a result of that. This is, of course, separate from a partisan gerrymandering case that's making its way through in other states. And that will sort of determine whether the lines can be drawn for purely for partisan advantage, which is what Republicans here are saying they want to do, that they're not going to do it based on race. They're going to do it based on how they can win. And we saw last week here that Tom Hoffler, the GOP gerrymandering guru, is headed back to North Carolina. He drew the maps that have been struck down. He's going to draw the new maps now. So certainly the concerns that Republicans are trying to mess with elections in a way that benefits their party, that's influencing a lot of the concerns that we're hearing here in North Carolina and elsewhere about the Federal Voter Fraud Commission. Certainly, it all kind of weaves together across the country, and North Carolina's ground zero.
And when you talk to Republican voters, what's their general sense of this? I mean, when you talk to your, not a Republican lawmaker, not someone who's actually going to have to stand for election, but someone who's going to cast a ballot, do they like the way these districts are made up because they think it's more likely they'll get more candidates that they like into office? Or do they see the problems with the kind of racial disparity?
Or are they not even paying attention at this level?
Yeah, I don't know if they pay attention that much. Certainly when you get outside of the people who are, you know, embroiled in partisan voters in politics, people are concerned that they just don't have the choice on the ballot. You know, I live in a district personally that's heavily gerrymandered, and my state representative has not been opposed on the ballot in the entire time I've lived out where I live. And I think that's a concern for a lot of voters, both Republicans and Democrats, that if you don't have competitive districts, you don't get a choice when it comes election time.
And this is the issue that former President Obama has taken up or has said he's going to take up in his post-presidency, right? I mean, it seems, like Kristen said, just not a sexy issue. Maybe we don't describe it well enough to people, but it's been bubbling up in so many states. It feels like it's just going to come to a head at some point, or maybe not, if nobody's paying attention.
Yeah.
I don't know.
And Eric Holder, the former attorney general, has been leading an initiative on this and was actually in North Carolina a few weeks ago to speak to a Democratic Party gathering about trying to create some sort of independent redistricting system and try to push that across the country as a better way to do things.
All right, Brian, you're up.
So a lot of people probably saw the news this week about President Donald Trump announcing that he wanted to restrict transgender soldiers from serving in the military. A lot of us woke up to him saying that on Twitter one day.
Dude,
I was still in bed when I first saw that.
Seriously, what kind of life are you living out there?
I'm an hour behind you guys. So I was like, just
right,
got out of
that's
bed.
It. Yeah,
let me check the president's Twitter. As soon as I saw that, I recognized the rhetoric that a lot of people probably didn't, that these words could have been totally written by Representative Vicky Hartzler of Missouri. Hartzler has been the one beating the drum on this. She was the one who first brought an amendment in the Armed Services Committee, which I think we'll listen to the clip, that would have reversed this Obama administration policy.
Is it fair to recruit our sons and daughters to fight for our nation and instead of being able to focus on the enemy, subjecting them to disturbing distractions of very personal privacy issues involving sleeping and showering with individuals born of the opposite sex? It is not.
She brought a more narrowly tailored thing on the House floor, which was defeated, that would have just prevented their medical services from being paid for. But then the president ended up going with her first idea, which is the total ban. Now, he still hasn't actually rolled out a policy beyond Twitter. Like a lot of things that President Trump does, this is just something that we've had a series of tweets that we have to interpret as policy. But Hartzler definitely played a role in raising this issue. And when I talked to her last week, she was certainly saying, well, you know, I think we caused discussion about this. I think we had people call. She had conversations with the White House herself. And I don't think many of us were paying attention to the issue of transgender troops 6 months ago. I don't think, or a year ago. I don't think this came up once in the campaign. All of a sudden, this one random Republican from Missouri started talking about it in committee. And now it's what the president says he's going to do.
You know, it had been a conversation among many conservatives for a very long time. And so, you know, while Representative Hartzler brought it to Washington this year in a way that it probably wasn't discussed in previous years and certainly wasn't discussed under the last administration, it is a topic that has been at a kind of a steady state of simmer among the conservative and evangelical communities. And I do wonder whether, you know, how it is playing in a place like North Carolina or in, you know, in South Florida. I can guess because socially South Florida is a little bit more liberal than they are perhaps, you know, on fiscal policy. But in North Carolina, Colin, did this get many headlines?
Not as much, which is a little bit surprising because obviously transgender equality issues have been huge in North Carolina. We were the state that had House Bill 2, the bathroom bill. So we've been talking about this stuff for a while. And I suspect here in North Carolina, people's opinions on Trump's transgender ban in the military pretty much mirrors how they viewed House Bill 2. Now, I've seen a lot of chatter about people trying to figure out the political implications of the Trump administration's position here. Is this going to hurt Trump politically across the country? And some people say, no, this is a minor issue. It'll be overshadowed by everything else. And others are saying, no, look at North Carolina. This issue in North Carolina of the bathroom bill caused the Republican governor to be defeated. I think, yeah, that is certainly a concern. And it highlights the political power of groups like the Human Rights Campaign, the major LGBT advocacy group that's really going to be pushing this issue hard. But at the same time, North Carolina's political fallout from House Bill 2 was a lot about the economic boycotts. And when something is a nationwide policy, I don't know that you see economic product boycotts targeting a certain entity for a loss of sporting events and that sort of thing.
Well, I will say there's a lot of veterans groups that are coming out very strongly against this. There's a lot of veterans groups that are critical of this, say if people want to serve, it shouldn't matter. I think, you know, that may be why you saw a large number of Republican lawmakers in Washington come out against this. A lot of social conservatives who aren't very forward thinking on LGBT rights came out against the total ban, including Kevin Yoder of Overland Park, Kansas, who had voted for Hartzler's more narrow amendment that would have prevented payment for medical treatment, came out against the total ban. He basically is adopting the attitude of transgender soldiers should be allowed to serve. We just shouldn't have to pay for their medical costs, which is a very Kevin Yoder way to approach a problem like this.
I feel like this week I'm playing the role of Chris Catalago and the People's Republic of California in South Florida. Just because, like Kristen said, this is not, I mean, the way this issue played down here for us as we tried to localize this story is we have a local Miami drag queen who has been a big Trump supporter and has said that he was blackballed by the LGBT community for his support for Trump. And he came out and said, like, oh, of course transgender people should be allowed to serve in the military. I disagree with the president on this. And it became a huge thing. So, you know, I think the fact that there was no policy that was articulated, I mean, other than the tweets, there was nothing in writing that the Defense Department was actually following, might be a sign of how this played out, like Brian said, maybe unexpectedly unpopular among some conservatives, though I imagine the evangelicals were pretty happy with the tweets, you know?
Right. And McClatchy, D.C. actually did report that the Pentagon seemed to be caught off guard by it.
Right.
The Pentagon's website still has up all of the information about the Obama policy. It's important to remember that nothing has actually been formalized yet in terms of what this administration is actually going to do. And it's a big question because you have roughly 6,000 or more soldiers, just speaking of the active duty military, who are transgender, and do they get discharged? You know, are they forced out of the military?
Talk about disruption to the troops.
Right, right. I mean, now that you've allowed people to come out as transgender, once you come out on that, you can't go back in any closet for that. So it's a big question for those soldiers.
It also is an opportunity for Donald Trump and his administration to kind of regroup based on the reaction, because as you said, the policy has not been implemented. The policy hasn't even been written. It was just a tweet. And the tweet has the force of a presidential directive, apparently, under this administration. But they've got a lot of opportunity here to work with the Pentagon and find a way out, perhaps.
Twitter is the new focus group. I don't know if you've heard.
Let's get into our second segment. Alex, thank you for joining me. And who are we talking with?
So we're talking with Charlie Kelly. He's the executive director of House Majority PAC, which is a super PAC. This is the modern era of politics. Every caucus in Congress has basically their own super PAC that is Nancy Pelosi approved. And he's the executive director, and their mission is to win House races.
They've done some studies, and they have shared with you some of their internal data. What does that data show?
Well, it shows the Democratic Party is in a deep hole with white working class voters.
Duh.
Right, which won't surprise anybody. But I think it maybe will surprise them just a little bit that even in the 6 months since Donald Trump took office, that they haven't necessarily made all that much progress. And so the House Majority PAC has actually for a couple of years now been undertaking this long study of this voter demographic. And they polled these voters in battleground districts, particularly in places like Michigan or Iowa, where in a lot of cases they make up the majority of the district. And what they established was, look, again, the Democrats are in a deep hole. And just as an example of that, in the generic House ballot test, Republicans lead 43% to 33%. That kind of 10-point edge, that's not going to get it done.
No, that's a huge gap, especially this close to the 2018 elections. I know it's funny to hear the word close and 2018 elections put together in the same sentence, but in political reality, it is pretty close. Can you please, before we call, explain to the listener what a generic House ballot is?
Sure. This is where you're just asking. You're not tying it to a particular district, and you're not putting anyone's name on it. It's just, who do you prefer to have in Congress, a Republican member or a Democratic member? It is kind of the way that the most broad way to test who's winning in the battle for the House. And so the study, you know, it did an initial assessment on these voters and asked what they feel about Republicans, what they feel about Democrats. The news wasn't good for Democrats. Now, where this test also tested or assessed some messages that Democrats could use, particularly on the economy. And this is where there's a little bit more optimism for Democrats. And you're going to hear Charlie say this, that if the Democrats can stick to an economic focus message, one that talks about meeting them where they are, working with companies, not necessarily going to college to attain the American dream, they can move back the Democrats. And this is why they see some hope, despite the numbers looking a little dire for them right now.
All right, Devin, let's call them.
Hey, Charlie, how are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing great. You ready to talk a little bit about this data that your group, the House Majority PAC, put together?
Yes, happy to. Yeah, glad to be on the phone with you all.
The information that your group put together is fascinating. It's a deep look at white working class voters, and it really came up with, I think, some findings that will discomfort Democrats, but also maybe give them a little bit of hope. How would you sum it up for us?
Yeah, I think that the data itself was sobering, and it's a reality. It's a look at sort of where we are, but I do think it shows a path forward and real opportunity. Traditionally, in my mind, Democrats have been the party of working families in this country, and I think in the recent past, we've seen a lot of these folks maybe potentially move from the Democratic Party to some degree. Maybe they're seeing a cultural and or economic disconnect. And I think that has, that's accelerated in the last couple of cycles. But I do think this data suggests if we, make the right connections and outline a positive economic agenda, that we have a path to bringing folks back, bringing these working families back into the Democratic Party, which has been a sort of hallmark of our efforts, traditionally.
So this internal data shows that white voters without a college degree still view Donald Trump relatively favorably, and their opinion of Democrats, as Alex wrote, is in the dumps. What's the upside here for you, and how do you turn that on its head?
Well, I think that if you look at that data, the baseline is not a particularly good place to start, but the start is not necessarily positive for either party. The sort of non-college white voters that were surveyed in battleground districts across the country didn't hold particularly rosy views of either party. And I think that what you saw is a fluidity among this electorate. And when given the opportunity and hearing sort of an economic message, and when hearing that folks are, offering up solutions and getting to the bottom of some of these challenges, that there was a resonance and that folks were willing to listen. And then obviously with the contrasting message and some of the economic messages, frankly, regarding the House GOP's plan on health care and beyond, there was a sharp change among this electorate. So I think the sentiment and mood certainly is for the Democratic Party to have success, and certainly success in the upper Midwest and upper Northeast. We need to get back to focusing on jobs and focusing on economic solutions that help, these folks and states across the country.
I think the most sobering, as you put it, data point in the study, on the question of which party creates jobs or is good for the economy, Republicans held, I believe it was a 35-point edge over Democrats. You don't have to be a political wizard to understand that that's a bad place for the Democrats to be. Now, you have said, the path back for Democrats is to talk about the economy, to talk about jobs. But there are ways that the Democrats have to talk about the economy and jobs, and maybe ways that they shouldn't do it, that I think this study gets into. Talk a little bit about that.
I think, again, working families, they're looking for a clear agenda, in my mind, that provides for economic opportunity. It makes clear that someone's looking out for them and that they have reason to feel good about the future. And so I think more recently, Democrats have tended to speak to classes of people with maybe specific programs or sort of identity-based politics to individuals. And I think that is not something that these individuals are looking for. They're looking for a path forward. And to me, the important thing is that we are, as a party, making a broad economic appeal to these folks, working men and women across this country, and meeting them where they are and really listening. And I think that, some of the items are, workforce training, different opportunities beyond sort of the traditional, 4-year higher ed programs, apprenticeships. We can't, based on the conversation we had, sort of force feeding the American dream on these individuals just doesn't work.
And I think you're talking about college when you say that, Charlie. I mean, that was one of the things that really stuck out to me on a question of college and whether or not, everyone should go to college. It wasn't just a message that didn't work. I mean, it almost backfired when it tested.
Yeah, and I think, again, these individuals, it's not that they have a bad view, they just don't know that that's the right path for them or the right investment for them. And so I think that, as a as a party and as an opportunity, we need to sort of diversify our economic appeal, and I think make a broader one, meeting voters and these individuals where they are.
You know, Charlie, it strikes me that the economic argument is actually a really tough one for you right now. I mean, we've got the president opening up this week with a tweet, as he very often does, right? He opens up the week with a tweet about how the stock market is hitting highs, the unemployment rate is at lows. While Republicans did not pass the Affordable Care Act repeal that they were hoping to, that frankly kind of denies Democrats an opportunity to say, look at what Republicans have done to your health care now. So, you know, when you look at this data and then you spin forward and look at 2018, how do you make an economic argument in an environment where the stock market is rewarding the current administration for whatever perceived strengths it has in job creation and unemployment is down as much as it is? And you can't count on the fact that Americans might actually have a negative personal impact felt by any change to health care.
The Republicans have tried time and again to sort of pass their version of health care. I feel like we'll see another iteration of that come September. The second point on that is any time that the Republican Party has sort of made inroads or an effort, whether it's on health care, tax reform, and beyond, the items and agenda that they're pursuing don't benefit hardworking families across this country. I think that if you see the sort of the tax agenda they're talking about, oftentimes those at the top are seeing the best benefits, certainly for their healthcare effort. And while we see some economic improvement with the stock market and some different places, largely among this electorate, folks are not seeing that benefit. Those folks at the top are being rewarded, but this doesn't translate to folks in the upper Midwest and those sort of non-college white voters that we surveyed. And I think that, again, we saw an opportunity and a fluidity within this electorate, and I think we're going to continue to see that because, again, when Democrats make an economic appeal and focus in on the sort of trademark issues that we've talked about historically and traditionally, we are the ones that are looking out for working families across this country. And we can make a clear contrast in a number of those issues, and I think that will resonate.
Let me ask you about trying to make that economic pitch because it isn't always that simple. I mean, we saw this just last week. On Monday, the Democratic congressional leaders rolled out a quote-unquote better deal agenda. I thought, you know, for a plan a whole year before an election was full of a lot of specifics like raising the minimum wage and taking on reviving some antitrust legislation. But by Wednesday, the president, again on Twitter, rolls out a new ban on transgender men and women in the military. And of course, the Democratic Party responds to this and they reacted vigorously to it, condemning it. At the same time, when they're doing that, they're not talking about the economy. And look, I, you know, this is a part of a pattern with the president who, if nothing else, is certainly able to change the dialogue in Washington across the country, whether it's on his Twitter account or through the policies that he enacts. How can the Democratic Party resist talking about these sort of things? Do they have to be worried that the president is going to be able to change the subject to cultural issues that won't help them reach these kinds of voters?
One, what Trump did last week deserved a strong and swift response because that was just wrong. On the economics regarding the Democratic Party, you know, I think that's sort of a false choice. The Democratic Party, and what was outlined last week, is a robust plan that supports and benefits hardworking Americans across this country, and certainly individuals in these districts we targeted. It provides an outlook on economic opportunity, a new look at jobs and sort of apprenticeship programs that has not been outlined in the sort of recent past. And so I think there will be a lot of resonance and a lot of support for that plan. That's not to say that you sort of can't do both. I mean, what the president did the other day deserved a response, but that doesn't mean that you can't push forward on the economic agenda and begin to sort of make inroads among this electorate.
You know, I think the economic agenda that was rolled out was noteworthy in one specific regard. It effectively spoke to the desires of two wings of the Democratic Party, the progressives and, you know, the more moderates or the centrists or however you want to cast that group of lawmakers and activists in the Democratic Party. But what we saw at an event that was going on simultaneously at the NAACP was, you know, some reaction among African-American activists that, you know, this agenda reflects the Democratic Party's desire to chase after white voters who are gone and not coming back. What do you say to that critique?
Well, one, the data suggests that that's just not the case. I think the economic security of this constituency and the needs and priorities of this group are very similar to those in the African American and Hispanic communities. Everyone wants to feel good about sort of his or her future prospects. I believe, and I think that we believe over at House Majority PAC, that that information transcends beyond this group. Our work in this portion of the electorate was simply to say, if we're going to make a real inroad and make an effort to sort of a path back, there is an opportunity here, but we need to make a concerted effort. That's not to say that we're not looking at other constituencies. We are. But I do think that sort of economic appeals, focusing in on jobs, I think that that translates beyond just this group.
Sure. Let me ask you, because when people and a lot of liberal analysts in particular size up the 2018 House map, one of the things they worry about is that the Democratic Party, they only go after these quote-unquote Panera districts, which are suburban, which maybe voted for John McCain or Mitt Romney in previous presidential elections, but swung for Hillary Clinton last time around. It's going to become a party of socially liberal, affluent suburbanites, basically. You're saying with this data and the way you're talking, and I know you and I have talked about this in the past, as far as House Majority PAC is concerned, you're not just focused on suburbia. You're focused on the upper Midwest, Michigan, Iowa, places that have traditionally been Democratic strongholds that have swung for Trump, but you think you can win them back.
Yeah, I mean, these places have Democratic DNA. Many of them voted for President Obama in 2008 or 2012 or both. They've moved away from us in recent years, but there is a path back. The data shows that. And for us to be successful this cycle, you know, we need to have an agenda and a strategy that looks at both of these types of districts. You know, we've won in the regions that I'm talking about, the working class white districts. The suburban districts are fast growing. There's certainly an appeal there, and we're going to be competitive there as well. But we can't make a serious effort to pick up seats by ignoring these working class white districts. And certainly, I think it also is important just from a larger sort of party position and the fact that these folks are saying, look, get back to basics. Talk about jobs. Talk about the economy. How do I feel good about the Democratic Party? I know maybe in, you know, sort of the recent past, I've been with you. I may be a little bit skeptical today, but I do think that, again, the data shows like we just need to get back to basics and we do our best when we're talking about jobs and sort of things that help working families.
Well, hey, Charlie, I want to thank you for coming on the program. Have a nice day.
Thanks so much, Charlie.
Thank you both.
All right, guys, let's get to the lightning round. Each of you is going to identify one politician making moves relevant to 2018 or 2020. And up first, Brian Lowry.
I'm going to go with the politician who has no choice now but to make moves, and that's Lieutenant Governor Jeff Collier of Kansas. Sam Brownback has been appointed ambassador at large for international religious freedom. Go back a few weeks, we talked about that possibility. Collier will most likely be the governor of Kansas in a few months, assuming that Brownback gets confirmed by the U.S. Senate. And so now the question of whether or not Collier enters the 2018 race is really the most interesting question in Kansas politics.
The reason I'm a doctor and the reason I'm lieutenant governor is to make a difference in people's lives. And for me, when I'm a doctor, I can work one-on-one, you know, with a person, and it affects their physical and a lot of their social side. When you're a lieutenant governor, though, it's that same idea of where do we want to be in 2025?
He would enter as the underdog. Even if he was a sitting governor, the fact that he'd be taking on Kris Kobach, who has a national profile, who can rely on the president to give him some tweets, is going to make it tough for Collier. So those first few months in office are going to be real key for him to set the stage.
All right, Alex, you're up.
So I'm going to focus on John Delaney. You're asking yourself, who is John Delaney? Well, he's running for president. he's a congressman from the Washington, D.C. area, actually in Maryland, who very suddenly, very unexpectedly last week declared that he's not going to run for election in Congress. He's not even going to run for governor in Maryland. He's going to run for president of the United States.
Democrats can't win by just attacking Trump. We really have to show the American people there's a better way. We have to think about the future.
And look, he is by any assessment a long shot, but why should you care about this? Because I think there are going to be a lot of John Delaneys in 2020. This is a Democratic field with no obvious front runner to speak of. And look, Donald Trump is president. So why not me? And that's what a lot of people are saying right now. And it's why he, I think, is someone who's pretty noteworthy right now.
Patty, you're up.
I am going to burrow into the Florida 27th Congressional District. This is the one that Republican Ileana Ross Layton is retiring from. And we have a sixth candidate announcing in the Democratic field. That is a former state judge, Mary Barzee Flores, who is particularly interested because she was nominated to the federal bench by former President Obama, and her nomination was scuttled by Marco Rubio. And she is now going to run for Congress. And the thing is, we expect a seventh candidate to jump in, Matt Hagman, who was once a Miami Herald reporter and recently worked at the Knight Foundation, and perhaps an eighth candidate, Miami City Commissioner Ken Russell. An eight-way Democratic primary just shows you how long people were waiting for the rare open Democratic-leaning seat down here.
Man, whoever wins, that's going to win by like 12 votes.
Yes.
Oh, God. All right. Colin Campbell, you're up.
I'm going with possibly the first vodka distillery owner to run for Congress, at least to my knowledge. This is Sam Searcy. He's from Durham, North Carolina. Recently announced he's going to be a Democrat challenging Congressman George Holding, a longtime Republican from Raleigh in the 2nd District of North Carolina in 2018.
Now I'm running for Congress to be a champion for people all over North Carolina who work hard and do their best but struggle in an economy that is often unfair.
Possibly one of the best-funded challengers to Holding so far. This is a seat that the DCCC has said that they're interested in trying to flip this year, and they've been recruiting candidates. Unclear whether the vodka distillery owner is the person that they're looking at. Certainly, he's had success with his line of Bedlam Vodka, which apparently was the official vodka of the ESPN ESPY Awards recently. So obviously, a well-funded campaign. He is one of two Democrats announcing so far. The other is actually a transgender military veteran. So it could be a very interesting Democratic primary here in North Carolina's 2nd.
I'm going with Mark Meadows of North Carolina. I'm going with him because he is the chairman of the Freedom Caucus. And right now, as Republicans are really desperate to find something on which they can win, they're looking at tax reform. And the American Action Network is including Meadows in their first round of spending on pro-tax reform ads.
Our tax code was made for the 20th century. We need a 21st century tax code that gives incentives to invest in America, innovate in America, and grow in America to raise the American standard of living. We need tax reform, permanent, structural, transformative changes in the tax code.
It's thanking members who are supportive, urging them to stay focused, and essentially warning them if they don't, there are going to be repercussions for 2018. So, Mark Meadows for me.
And Searcy will be the first distillery owner until George Clooney runs, and then we bill him as a tequila.
Clooney, Kid Rock. This is going to be some crazy 18. Thank you to Colin, Brian, Patty, and Alex, and of course, executive producer Davin Coburn. And thank you to our listeners. We want to hear from you, so please keep sending your questions and your comments to btb@mcclatchy.com. Tell us what you're seeing in your battleground state. Check us out on Apple Podcasts, TuneIn, Stitcher, or whatever podcast app you use. Leave us a review and tell us what you think. Talk to you next week. Why did you call yourself Patricia today?
Oh, I don't know. I don't normally do that. I'm really rusty, man. It's already been a long week, and it's only Monday. Does he get to go as Kid Rock on the ballot?
He has to use his non-stage name, actually.
Really?
This is actually a thing that people are talking about, is that if they become serious about this, which they could, they have to start introducing his real name into the conversation, because no one's going to have any idea who he is.
Could he legally change his name to Kid Rock?
I don't know.
I was having a conversation with somebody yesterday who said the name to me, and I said, who the f*** is that? They're like, Kid Rock.
The interwebs informs me it's Robert James Ritchie.
That's the one.
You have destroyed my blooper reel here. You really have.
It's not a secret that
Jersey
I have
Jersey Kristen
bad.
Over here.
I mean, like...
I'm pretty sure the Mooch is down with this approach to getting the message
only
out.
The Mooch had been the one to announce this policy.
I don't want to talk about this anymore.
I refuse to say the Mooch.
I know!
I grew up in Philly. I knew a lot of guys like the Mooch.
Yeah. Ditto, man.
What do you think of the Senate chances of Bob Ritchie?
Bob Ritchie?
Robert Ritchie.
Oh, God. Look, the best place to be in American politics right now is to be a non-traditional politician. You come from outside the system. You want to blow up the system. And who better than Kid Rock himself
well
to do that?
Well done, Alex.
That was beautiful.
Done.
I'm serious.
Boy.
I'm not even kidding.